Thank you. Thanks to everybody for coming here after a very late night and rainy morning. So to listen to this talk from George Athamos from the very nice island of
Crete
in Greece, with the main from I think the main city there, Heraklion.
Yeah, indeed.
He will talk about free and open source software and the counter globalization movement. Please go ahead.
I'd like to thank you all for attending. It's quite a pleasure. It's an honor being here among you people, especially given that last night had been a very liquid night. So I'll go on. What's this presentation about? A couple of years ago, I attended the first Econux meeting, and the whole concern over whether globalization acts in malicious ways was underway, was, you know, a very heated debate. And I happened to have this idea whether globalization as a process could be modeled upon free software, upon several methods, several techniques, several community-centric notions of governance. If you look at it, how free software is developed throughout the last 10 years, say. I mean, Linux, if you look at it from a purely economic, socioeconomic perspective, is quite subversive. In the absence of direct monetary returns, we have a quality product and quite a cohesive community of people. That led lots of business people wonder whether it's sustainable, how they can make money out of it. I mean, there's this question, who develops free software? If I'm a businessman, I need to know who develops it so that I know how to employ that person, to subvert that person, to manipulate that person. I don't use the word manipulation in a negative sense. I mean, we usually associate the word exploitation with a negative connotation, but that's not what I mean by saying being exploited. I'm just saying that throughout the last 10 years, we see huge investments of money and resources, business resources, flowing into the free software community. Why is this happening? The most easy answer I can come up with is because free software developers can be subsumed under capitalism. I mean, they're being given jobs. Increasingly more companies employ increasingly more free software developers. Does that mean that can be co-opted by the business world? Does it mean that free software can be exploited to such by such an order of magnitude that's no longer free? Or, as Stefan Mertens says, are we going towards a GPL society, a society in which the collaborative sphere has swallowed the commercial sphere? The first aspect that comes to my mind when looking at this relationship, at these questions, is what does Libre Software, LS stands for Libre Software. There is a distinction between free software and open source software. When I need to stress that difference, that distinction, that dichotomy, I use the word, the term open source or free software, respectively. When I use the term Libre Software or LS, I'm not making any difference. I don't differentiate between free software and open source. This question, what actually means to say is, why Libre Software developers are business friendly? At the end of the 90s, we saw lots of people investing their time in order to pick up free software development skills. But why? They could either they could either embark on a .com, and besides, technology is something really important, really lying at the core of the current world market. I mean, It's no coincidence that Nasdaq was perhaps the most significant component of the stock exchange boom during the 90s, or that so many dot-com enterprises. I mean, even nowadays, what I do outside of my hobbies is trying to bring more businesses. Can I please... I'll be better. Yeah. Even nowadays, in the aftermath of the dot-com collapse, there are huge investments flowing into dot-coms and trying to convince people to migrate their operating processes to the net. Why? Because there's still hope, there's still enthusiasm in the dot-com way. Why? Maybe it's all about self-rule. David Weinberger, I don't know if I pronounce his name correctly, says that all this craze, the dot-com craze, had been about one thing, self-rule, that people want to change the relationship between labor, basically, and the employment contract, if I may put it this way. And on top of that, we have valid evidence that, welcome Stefan, valid evidence that increasingly more free software developers do it, develop software because of financial incentives, whether these are direct returns or indirect, is not so important. Let me digress for a minute. If you would like to ask something or interrupt, or you don't understand what I'm saying, I'm not native English speaker, therefore what I say might be misunderstood, or so please, you know, interrupt me anytime, just, you know, shout or raise hand, or, you know, do anything you fancy, basically. I'm not going to mind. What I'm trying to say now is that while in the very beginning, at least, of the free software development paradigm booming in the early 90s with Linux and Apache and the whole web bringing so much attention to the free software world, nowadays we see similarly important shift towards commercialization of this development paradigm. It's no coincidence that increasingly more researchers identify this huge shift. For example, Gregor Rothfuss, he's one of the core OSCOM people. I mean, he's a developer. He's not an academic. He says reputation does not put food on the table. And I suppose, I mean, if we ask Graham or anyone else, I suppose they know what Rothfuss means. David Lancashire, in another key text, says that hacking falls and rises inversely to its, come on, to its opportunity cost, which means that free software developers will develop software only when they know that there's a market opportunity to make money out of it. And please.
The David Lancashire thesis, I think it was wrong, but it was a very good thesis because it's empirically testable on statistics. The time it was written was really, it was relying on data from the dot-com boom. Now, there's been a long period after when the dot-com boom went down and so on, and there was a lot of unemployment program. It would be very easy to test that thesis by looking at statistics now. What is the number of projects taking place that... Did free software projects stop with the dot-com boom, with the decrease in employment? I think I'm almost certain you'll find that his correlation is wrong. But I don't know, do you know if anybody's ever done that? Go back, look with modern data?
I have no idea, but I don't think its main thesis has been revisited, at least recently. But was convincing. I mean, reading it made me think twice about whether hackers gravitate to where... business opportunities arise. So should you neglect? Yeah, please.
I also have a related question. So if this is virtual, I just won't say anything. What do the hackers do after they have been employed by dot-com? So do they remain free software developers in their spare time, or don't they?
as says that also signaling effects, networks effects, play an important role in free software development, which means I might be unemployed, I don't have a job, I'm on the lookout for a new job, but in the meantime I have nothing to do with my free time. So I'd rather spend some time picking up the skills that will come of value later on in my life, in my career, so as to enhance my employability. Even if someone is unemployed, they may choose to join a non-profit effort, so as, you know, to put down their CV that they're not lazy, they're not, you know, just sitting on their ass doing nothing. They're workaholics, they are attuned to the market, even when the proper market has collapsed. Please.
Yeah, from my personal experience, confirms that to some extent. Recently with Pearl Jobs in London, and some companies have started advertising, was one recently that said, as a condition of employment, you must have submitted at least one widely used module to CPAN. You must have created a free software module to be interviewed. And also, I think the other thing is that there are a lot of the jobs are contract jobs or they're short-term jobs, so that it's not a case of somebody who's using free software as a way of signaling reputation and getting jobs can stop when they have a job, because they have to think about their next job, their next contract. So I really do think this is a part of it. What I don't like is the idea, this is the thing, that the single key that explains everything, which I think is wrong. I think there are so many other factors, and this is only one of the factors.
Further evidence to this shift is even the distinction between free software and open source, which boils down to commercial attractiveness. The main point of departure is exactly that, is good marketing, good public relations. When those group of leaders of the free software world came together in 1997 to find a better way to promote what they've been doing, they came up with the term open source, because it shuns any references to free as in free beer. And the whole effort they put into it was about how to commercialize, how to turn it into a business-friendly product or service. The focus is no longer on freedom of information or of human expression. It's on being a tangible revenue stream. On the other hand, if you look at Linux, I mean, a great economist from Vienna, Joseph Schumpeter, once tried to analyze the dynamics of capitalism. And his own view was that capitalism cannot be a static model. It's by definition an evolving artifact, and can only see it as a socio-economic construct throughout time. Therefore, it changes depending on what forces affect the course of history. Thus, Linux can be conceptualized as the finest illustration of creative destruction, of the theory of the process of creative destruction in action, since from a student hobby done just for fun, turned to a very practical, very viable solution for the main average user or for the main average organization for in-house deployment purposes.
I just don't get it. Sorry, you've lost me here. I don't understand why you would call this creative destruction.
Joseph Schumpeter. I need just to provide a little bit of background. Schumpeter predicted that when institutionalization will be massive, when institutionalization will be the dominant creature of economic activity, meaning that the lone innovator, the entrepreneur, as someone who does what he feels like all alone without succumbing to institutional pressures, when this person, the inventor, we may call it, the innovator, is no longer able to innovate, then we have reached the terminal stage of capitalism, when institutionalization does not allow someone to innovate, according to Sumbera, is the end of capitalism. And only then, he says, can we see true creative destruction. What is creative destruction? This process of innovation being completely uncontrollable, being completely unseen, undiagnosed by commercial radars. But then on the other hand, Schumpeter takes into account that this creative destruction, this artifact can be exploited by the system to a certain extent. So why is Linux creative destruction? It is creative destruction because within a wider frame of institutionalization, like we have the World Trade Organization, we have a series of institutional instruments pertaining to patents, to copyright law, pertaining to everything. I mean, this world is an institutionalized one, the way I see it. In order to do anything, you have to apply for a patent, you have to copyright your work, you have to concern yourself with the rights and how the wider legal framework will be embedded in what you're trying to pull business-wise. And since Linux started completely irrelevantly, completely independently of institutional pressures, and it's been turned into a major marketplace player nowadays. I don't know, do I seem to be more comprehensive this time, or I can't elaborate on...
I mean, we shouldn't struggle about words, but the reason I objected is that I do feel there is a danger here, if one puts it like this. I mean, I know about the Schumpeter thing, and this is located within a general theory of capitalism, and okay, creative destruction as used there. But Linux is, I don't think that the cause of Linux is well served, if one describes this as creative destruction. And at least for at least two reasons. One reason is that I'm not quite, as we know, IBM and the big companies are making extensive use of Linux now. Is this Linux destructing capitalism? Who is destructing whom? If IBM is pushing enormous amounts of money into Linux, that's one. More pragmatic point. The second point, which is more on a conceptual level, I just don't like Linux to be associated with destruction. It's an alternative. I mean, of course, there is a way to say if there is a viable alternative to something, it is indirectly sort of pushing down, destructing, or whatever, what it is an alternative of. But I don't think you get the right feeling if you describe it like this.
I entirely agree with you that sometimes words, connotations, or labels like creative destruction can only do harm in order to reach higher state of understanding. So we drop the creative destruction thing. I mean, what you're saying is one of the main questions that I've been wrestling with. I mean, is Linux creatively destructing those businesses, those people deploying it, or is it being embedded? Is it being subsumed under capitalism? This is basically the main question of this presentation, to which I don't claim to have the answer. I feel that both things, both forces, are in conflict. On the one hand, Linux is still free software in general, is still subversive, is still a different model of society, different model of economics, a different model of governance, therefore politics. But on the other hand, we see Linux being so smoothly adapted to several organizations' needs, like IBM's. I don't think that IBM regards Linux as subversive in any meaningful way. It's been completely embedded into their business strategy, therefore subsumed. I mean, This was just an introduction to free software, to the questions we'll deal with during this presentation. And now I digress to make a similar introduction to the counter-globalization movement. What's the counter-globalization movement? There's no definition, with the exception of several philosophical or political philosophical definitions given recently, like the multitude, whether the multitude is the counter-globalization movement. Yes, for some people it is exactly the same. But I don't have a definition to offer. All I can do is observe several characteristics, several identifying traits of it. It seems like being leaderless, having no leader. Who's the leader of all those anti-globalization activists? I can't identify anyone. Some people are more visible than others. For instance, Tony Negri has received lots of recognition for Empire as theoretical backbone, providing the movement with an analysis of where the current world system is heading to. But there is no leader, at least not from where I stand. It's also everywhere. There's counter-globalization movement everywhere in this world, starting with Seattle and moving on to many other countries where G8 or any meeting, any debate that's relevant to the globalization theme takes place. There's also a counter-globalization movement around the corner. The most key thing is there's no structured agenda for debate, meaning there are no specific list of issues that a for globalization spokesperson, a for globalization individual, an individual supporting globalization, basically supporting the case for increased globalization, could deal with. And since there is no structured agenda, the case of the counter-globalization movement cannot be answered, cannot be dealt with easily. Then again, not everyone agrees. Negri and Hart say this, this diversity in the agenda, if there is any agenda at all, is a necessity, since the terrain of struggle has moved outside of the factory floor to encompass all of life. Then this non-agenda is not a non-agenda, but a perfectly well-structured agenda to encompass, to ask, to demand for change in the ways we live, in the ways we communicate, in the ways we travel, in the ways we deal with exchange and we deal with other humans. For more information, you can refer to the Empire or to Loving's, to Geert Loving's latest book, where it's been made quite explicit that he thinks tactical media organizations and counter-globalization movement in at large know what they want, they know what they ask for, and they are asking for it quite explicitly. I don't see it this way. I see this lack of a clear agenda being grounds for more pessimism, meaning everyone can start whinging, I don't like globalization, globalization is evil, we should smash windows, should start throwing stones. And regardless of, there is grounds for a violent revolution, if there are such grounds, I can't tell. But it's obvious that the lack of specific set of arguments, of a specific set of demands set upon politicians, set upon society, leads to more pessimists. Do you agree with me? Am I seeing it from their own perspective? I'm here to ask those questions and to get this wisdom out of you. Do you see an agenda for change, or you don't see an agenda at all? Say again?
What do we get paid?
Nothing.
Is it wisdom?
It's not exactly wisdom, but you can have it through. It's not that I sort of agree with the wider framework, but I have a serious problem with the idea of counter globalization. I don't really understand. And I've never understood this idea of anti and counter globalization when people from around the world get together, how can they be against globalization? I mean, this might be slightly pedantic, but I think in some sort of way we depart from a wrong point of view if we think that this movement is about anti globalization. It's just maybe that globalization has been framed and been given this label because of certain economic structures and dynamics, but that's only just one little thing of it. And especially in this context here, where we're talking about free software and internet and so on, it really is like just another form of globalization. It's not against globalization at all.
I'd like to reinforce that the term counter-globalization started off from, it was a label that was put on a movement which didn't have a name and nobody knew how to describe it, and I think the movement itself would be the last agent that would be able to label itself, because it's got this multitude quality, this contradictory thing, this mix, this puzzle of Deutsch, I think it was jigsaw, this jigsaw of lots and lots of different groups, patchwork. And people have now started to talk about the ultra-mondialismus, you know, the sort of another globalization movement for another globalization. And more people are starting to talk about global governance as one of the main problems. And I'm observing that in the struggles for free movement or that no border stuff, refugee migrant organizations, they are starting to attack organizations like the IOM for being this global governance management system. And the same is happening with Stallman campaigning against the software patents, and of course he's not on his own. I mean, he is a sort of figurehead of some movement, and that's again against the type of global governance. Because of course Stallman and the new stories, I mean, that is another type of governance, but it's not that global, capitalist, neoliberal style of governing. So maybe, I'm missing points on the agenda of this movement. I'm getting a bit impatient after 5 years. I think there should be an agenda. I'm looking for qualitative points, but I think they're very, very difficult to find. But it is possible to find conversing strands in all the different bits of the movements. I mean, free movement and free communication are only two strands. I think you can observe that in different parts of it as well. I think it's also a kind of, it's not against globalization, it's about how to make a better world within what is happening and maybe change everything. I mean, yes, there are revolutionary ideas in it, but I think everybody is trying to survive in that stream of globalization. So it's trying to find ways to organize globally, and it uses the internet, it uses the streets, it uses global convergences where people meet face to face. And it's trying to create a different communication space in order to develop the agenda, which might be right now the agenda itself.
I agree with everything said. The difference being is, the main difference, I mean, we can say counter-globalization movement, in the absence of a more appropriate term to draw upon, I'm not defining what counter-globalization is. I mean, obviously, it's thousands, myriad of groups dealing with several aspects influenced, affected by the process of socioeconomic globalization. And how all those groups come together. They come together through IMC, through independent websites, and especially when the time comes to hit the streets, they're effectively controlled, influenced, directed by the media, by independent media centers. Thus, if we want to have an anatomy of the counter-globalization movement, we've got various groups dealing with specific issues of the environment, let's say, of human rights, of economic reform, of drug reform, of sexual consciousness, of so many things. And they come under the banner of counter-globalization movement. But what I was trying to say is, with the notable exception of George Soros, in his book, George Soros on Globalization, he's proposing an agenda for reform of global institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization. He's basically saying that all those global institutions are not as harmful as we may think. The problem is that they're not being complemented by equally global institutions that cater for social aspects. It's a bit naive to assume that economic growth would automatically be paralleled with social growth. And in the same way that we need global economic institutions, as an economist, I believe we do need global economic institutions, but we also need global institutions focused on social aspects of globalization, not purely economic aspects. Johan, something to add?
Sorry, what does GM, and RMS
mean? RMS, an acronym, stands for Richard Matthew Stallman. And IMC is the Indymedia, Independent Media Center. One sentence. Richard Matthew Stallman is the founder of the GNU project, which remains to this day the most vibrant political idea on the net. And 99% of the people attending this conference were influenced by this crusade. The crusade to recreate a community of software developers centered around digital freedom and community rather than making money. That's a GNU project. It was his idea to reproduce, to recreate a free, an entirely free as in freedom operating system. And GNU stands for GNU's not Unix. And so that's why the free software community intersects, is aligned with the counter-globalization movement. And please, you know, forgive me for using this term, since, as we all said, it's not the most appropriate. But I don't have any other. And also the Indymedia, as we said, there is this fabulous self-published work online. A Headmap is the name of the group. And they're dealing about distributed mapping. And I've come across the most succinct definition of what Indymedia is in that document. By the act of reporting, they de facto, it's missing a Y there, they de facto, they effectively direct the protests. And both Linux and Indymedia are examples of distributed communities made possible because of the internet. And both have relatively flat contribution and merit-based hierarchies. So the first thing that binds the free software community to the counter-globalization movement is the GNU project, is RMS. It's Richard Matthew Stallman's dedication to shattering the commercial model of developing software. I mean, if that's not anti-business, then what it is. Also, as a central theme of this gathering of people, it's been the question whether free software represents something more than software, something more than developing technology. And this question revolves around work ethic, around whether the free software development paradigm can be seen as a new way of labor, as a new way of working socially, and whether this collaboration that we see being very visible among free software people, among free software developers, is immanent to the new form of labor nowadays, whether this spirit of collaboration is indeed a new form of work ethic that's bound to shatter the previous work ethic that Max Weber is calling the Protestant work ethic. There's a book on it, it's The Hacker Ethic by Himanen, and it also includes a couple of chapters from Manuel Castells, the most well-known sociologist when it comes to internet and how it affects society and economics. And from Linux Torvalds contributed a chapter as well. Basically, what they say is that hackers, I mean, this is a sociological topic, so you might be more more appropriate person to deal with the issue. I can't match your expertise. But this book is based on the premise that hackers or free software developers are only good people. I mean, there are people being passionate about what they do. They value and respect everyone. They are not going to do any harm to anyone whatsoever. And nowadays, we see, I don't know if that's only a fraction, a small fraction of the free software community, but many people calling themselves hackers and being actual hackers are no longer scientists developing free software. There are also people developing quality software, being scientists, but also aiming at destroying something, especially information good existing online. And by association, creating a company or creating a government. During the Iraq bombings, there was many websites being attacked by hackers. And those hackers are not being paid. I don't know who pays them. But I agree with Geert Loving saying that being a hacker and being anti-globalization is no longer a striking phenomenon. It slowly but gradually becomes the norm. Do you agree with me? I'm not a free software developer. Is this dichotomy between good hacker and bad hacker coming to an end? Yes, yeah, indeed.
As I said yesterday in my talk, I personally, I think hacker is a notion which in a postmodern society should be taken as kind of self-expression. So it's just like a self-performance in society. People interpret hacker differently. And I personally think hacker could be interpreted in a bad way as well, a good way. That's the reason why we need hacker ethic. There's a reason why ethics is important, because it tells you people what are you going to be a good hacker rather than a bad hacker. But I personally also think it's quite difficult to draw a line between so-called white hat or black hat, because according to my research, most of my interviewees, they, when they tell me their life stories, how they become, later become a software programmer, and they told me that when they were little, they actually did a lot of script kiddy things, like cracking into a web page and destroy something. But that's just their way of self-expression when they were young, so you can see this change. And so personally, I just don't think it's necessary to draw a very clear line between what is bad hacker and what is good hacker, because everything is quite
so clear. This dichotomy no longer exists between good hacker and bad hacker.
There still exists, but sometimes because
to a certain extent, I mean, I'm not referring to script kiddies or downloading some automated software off the web and, you know, playing with it so as to create unintentionally or intentionally, it doesn't matter, some havoc.
I think it's very much situational. Sometimes when I do like quirky things, actually it's just because the other person do not have the same opinion as them, so I take it as kind of a political action to do the quirky. But somehow they might still do the good things to help the entity, to help the society and support. And so people see that their actions are actually situated in what they consider. So actually you cannot just judge this person saying, yes, he is definitely a bad partner or he is definitely a good partner. It depends on the situation, what kind of situation they support. And I just personally don't think it's necessary to put a hacker. It's like a heart of a person saying that, yes, you are good or you are bad.
So if we try to develop an epistemological definition, ontological definition of what a hacker is, can we still differentiate between a hacker as a scientist and a cracker as someone who breaks into systems? Is this line still there or is it more blur?
If you look at the practice, so that's the reason why I come from a very pragmatic view that I don't think you should do it like a pick a human or do it like a
human. The reference I found are human and Graham. He says that all people, regardless of whether they develop software or being gardeners or being economists or whatever, hacking is not about software or technology in specific. It's about a specific attitude towards life, towards the acquisition of knowledge, towards the socialization of work and knowledge. And Andrews, I don't know if Andrews is in the room. No, he skipped it. Andrews, a blog also attending and speaking at Canucks, has written a paper called Social Hacking.
And but I'm just saying that there is no clear line between white heart and black heart. No clear line between good partner or bad partner. Because basically, it's sociologically speaking, it's a notion. It's not a norm. Norm is not definite, but notions are interpretable. And in a society which is a diverse, it's just difficult to distinguish or to define what is really happening.
We're both saying the same thing. I mean, this is not a debate. You know, we're agreeing with each other. Please, Johan.
Yes, I just think of a parallel from the skinhead universe, actually, where the media very much created an image of skinheads as Nazis, where the ads, working class, Jamaican, you know, all this. And their response was quite negative. They, or I would say quite self-destructive, they created a name for the Nazi skinheads, which was boneheads. And basically, a movement which was a youth movement targeting, which was very politicized. And the active capital, it became a struggle between boneheads and skinheads, basically. And it's just, I would say, rest into violence in those two offices. And I would, you know, just taking a parallel of seeing the cracker hacking situation is something similar, a way of controlling the subjectivity of emotion.
You said in two words what I was trying to say and needed 1,000 words. So thanks for contributing that, both of you. Moving on to the next slide. Why is the community also in alignment with certain part of the dialectic, of the rhetoric, of the thesis of the counter-globalization movement? SEO is the latest example. The love and hate relationship with Microsoft is another example. As I write and slide, the community has always been a little bit concerned about the true incentives of organizations backing free software. And there are also many other forces currently underway that are trying to take over the internet, whether you choose to call them intellectual property agendas, whether you choose to call them e-commerce driven agendas. But it's obvious, I mean, I haven't been online since the time that I suppose Graham's been online, but it's obvious, I mean, most of the people coming to the web nowadays, all they see is commercial web email like Yahoo, eBay, Amazon.com. So why is it for them? Is it about downloading porn, sharing music, communicating via email? But it's not about non-commercial internet. I mean, for most people, for most newcomers to cyberspace, cyberspace can very well be commercial. And in fact, they expect the internet to be commercial. That's why they come online. That's why they get on board. If it wasn't commercial, they think it wouldn't be safe for them, or that it wouldn't be cut for them, it wouldn't be tailored for what they need. I'm just trying to elaborate a little bit more on that. For example, Lessig said that unless corporations and governments together work in collaboration, work in trying to subvert the internet. How to subvert it? By changing one of the technological layers that make the internet what it actually is. I mean, the internet is not nowhere. It takes shape and form through certain technology components, whether that is a Cisco router or bind, let's say, the DNS system. So according to this regime change, they're trying to pull free software developers might be effectively criminalized. There was a law been very much discussed last year according to which fiddling with any technology or trying to reverse engineer any technology would be effectively illegal. And if we see software as a machine that cannot be tweaked, that cannot be reverse engineered, then the whole spectrum of free software activities comes to a halt, stops existing. So this is another grounds for concern over the stance the free software community will adopt with respect to the wider globalization debate. Just to focus on only a few main theses that are being widely circulated among the among counter-globalization supporters. I have chosen to downplay books like, I mean, the view of Negri, the view of Jeremy Rifkin, which, in my own opinion, is equally important in trying to understand the shift from ownership to access, from isolated communities to network communities, whether business or social or friend communities. So we see John Gray, he's a professor of political science at LSE, and he seems to suggest that people suffer from what Karl Marx called false consciousness, that people don't understand, fail to recognize where their true interests lie. And he also goes on and says all things modeled on the free market model are inherently evil, and goes on and on and on, but he's lacking the grounding in real world economics to substantiate effectively his arguments. Thus, this remains a cultural capitalism criticism, but cannot be counter-argued. For example, some people say that this world is only an image, is nothing real. Wake up in the morning, watch MTV, doing a work you don't like, relationship among people mostly fake, Therefore, it's all image, it's all desire-driven, it's all a dream, a fantasy, you know, choose a word. But you cannot counter-argue with such a theorist, with such a concept of the economy in general. You cannot counter-prove that all things based on the free market model are not evil, or that people suffer from a false consciousness. I mean, I'm obviously, just like everyone else, subjective, having certain views about certain things that are highly personal, highly subjective. Therefore, to a certain extent, I'm bound to subscribe to this false consciousness concept. There is also Naomi Klein saying that marketing is culture, as manufacturing degrades in importance and manufacturing moves on to cheaper production sites, offshoring and sweet shops as a result of that come into being. And since this whole shift in manufacturing degrading in importance, marketing arises as the central area of focus, and it becomes so important, I mean, marketing nowadays, that it's been actually the new age culture. Are you wearing Nike shoes? I believe we share the same culture. You see that in the rave culture nowadays, the free rave movement. I don't know, are there any free raves going on still in England? Quite, are they? Manchester? All the time. Good to hear. But in many other places, free raves have perished. They're no longer taking place. For example, in Greece, what a rave is about is a certain piece of gear having fluorescent clothes, like this stuff, or having a certain model of Adidas shoes, perhaps, or Nike, or dyeing your hair in a specific way. It's all about images. Even the notion of ecstasy in countries like Greece is purely commodified, commercialized, purely seen as an add-on, as a complementary image to another image. For instance, there's this marvelous book written by Douglas Rushkoff, Siberia. It's one of mid-80s, I don't know if anyone's read it. Siberia, Life from the Trenches of Cyberspace. Have you? Siberia, Douglas Rushkoff. Anyway, he says that rave back in the time when the book was written was not about a DJ. I mean, people didn't know who was DJing at a rave, and they didn't care. That was the most important. Rave was about being connected with other human beings, not going to a concert to listen to someone DJing, whereas nowadays it's completely the opposite. With the exception of free raves. People go to rave to listen to, I don't know, whoever. They're not going for the rave itself. So you see this marketing as culture paradigm being deeply rooted, deeply embedded in modern cultural, cognitive, intellectual capitalism. But where John Gray's lacking economic grounding, Norina Herz kicks in, steps in, and her main thesis is that politicians are now useless, they have no power, no control over this world, because they've delegated everything to businessmen. Businessmen are nowadays expected to tackle social problems. Bill Gates donating computers to poor countries. George Soros saying, I'll put my mouth where my money where my mouth is, donate $2 billion to fight against Bush. And, I mean, what's that? Is democracy takeover? Or is it... I was told by a friend of mine that he says, ah, good for George Soros, what a nice blog. He's giving so much money to fight George Bush. And I'm saying it shouldn't be this way. I mean, if the Republic, if the people do not like him, they should be able, you know, even to hang him. They shouldn't be needing George Soros or any other George Soros for that matter to say, I'll put my money where my mouth is. So that's basically what Norina Hertz is saying in her book, Global Capitalism and the Corporate Takeover of Democracy. That's the name, the title of the book. And also have George Monbiot, who's more like a typical activist. He used to be anyway, been imprisoned, been shot during protests. And he agrees with me when saying that we need global institutions, but we don't need those institutions being driven by corporate agendas or by political agendas. We need those institutions to be democratic and being constituted through interaction, interaction with the public, not with a select few individuals meeting at Davos or at the World Trade Organization building or in similar social context. What was my motivation for doing this presentation? I think that many of the problems, many of the social and economic downturns, downsides of the process of socioeconomic globalization can be solved if we take an approach modeled upon the free software world. For example, marketing within the free software community is not really corporate driven, it's not really coercive, it's not like you're being bombarded by thousands of ads every day. I mean, okay, there are banner ads at sites like Slashdot, at SourceForge, at many various sites. But most of the actual marketing process that takes place within the community, from one software developer to another, is of mouth-to-mouth kind. I'm having a problem with specific technology. I'm going to go to a mailing list, ask a question, or I'm going to ask my own personal gurus. I mean, when it comes to several projects, like there was Van Gukes in the room, who's feeling very strongly for MAT and VI. Therefore, if I want to deploy, if I want to use VI and MAT, and I have a problem, I'm not going to go to Sun or Microsoft and say, I'm using this technology, can you please help me out? I'm going to drop him a line and say, Sven, I'm having this problem, can you please point me to a source where I can find the information I need? Or can you please tell me how to solve my problems, how to deal with it? Second, we still see that community formation, community life is important for software to be of quality. Unless there is a strong community backing the technology is not going to move forward. We see that with OpenOffice. There is a very strong community behind OpenOffice, and it's becoming a very quality product. I mean, check this out. I mean, very useful, very usable for all kinds of users. It's the same with Linux or with Apache. It's not only how many core developers are in the project, like say, but how many people have coalesced, have aggregated around the technology, both in terms of developers, users, and people interested in supporting this environment. So community life is important for the final service or product or the final technological artifact, to be precise, to be quality. Industrial fragmentation and consolidation are avoided as a result of intra-industry sharing of information in the form of source code. There was a European Union report, it's a couple of years ago, saying that since they focused only on the GNU GPL, therefore this specific point that industrial fragmentation, consolidation are being avoided because of source code being shared is only GNU-GPL specific. It doesn't apply, it lacks substance if you try to apply this to other licenses. But basically when you share source code, which means you share the product specs, you share the knowledge behind the product or a service, then another company has not really the incentive to do exactly the same. They try to be differentiated, to be slightly modified. Therefore, this sharing of information, this openness of product specs, creates 1,000 small micro markets instead of assuming or creating a big one. And to see that in Linux is the best example. Is my Linux the same as yours? I doubt it. I mean, I'm not a developer. I want Linux only for a couple of things: web browsing, OpenOffice, email, just the most basic things. Whereas an organization needs Linux in an entirely different form. Thus, there is no single market. Some people like to think that there are two markets, the business market and the desktop market. But it's not. There are 1,000 markets. It's catering for a specific small niche, if I may use this word. And since community life is important for this final technology artifact to be of quality, to be of use, then we come to conclude that the political process of the community dictate corporate behavior and precede firm strategy, which, come to think of right now, I don't know if I agree. That was the conclusion, that was my view 3 years ago. Right now, with the increasing commercialization of free software, I tend to assume that it's not that precise as an argument. I'm not absolute any longer. Which is the same question we asked before, whether free software has been subverted, it's been subsumed under capitalism or not. More about liberal software marketing. Should what you said, there was a debate over at SourceForge, at NewsForge, I'm sorry, in 2002. Some people said what Linux needs not features but marketing, and there were references to a classic book by Neil Stephenson. In the beginning, there was the command line. The book is really nice. I mean, it's a critique of society and of the business world based on metaphors and analogies. For example, in the book, Neil Stephenson is trying to explain the operating system market and says, for example, there is Apple, which is a nice Ferrari or Porsche, and people, you know, going for an Apple want to be stylish, they want to show off, they like class and finesse, they're really interested in the looks. There are people going for a Honda, which is Microsoft Windows. It's everyone is driving it, they know where to find it, and basically that's the reason everyone's buying that car, Honda. Or you can use your own analogy. I mean, if you think a Fiat is more widespread, then you can say Fiat. And then he comes to explain Linux, and he says Linux is like a very flexible Batmobile, the car of Batman. It can be customizable, it can be very strong, very fast, very effective. It can go into the jungle, or it can fly into outer space. And what's more important? What?
It just has too many buttons, and you just confused, don't know which ones to push.
And the car to this Batmobile, to Linux, are right inside the car. So anyone can walk up, open the door, and, you know, drive away with a car. And on top of that, there are people that you run into and they say, do you like this Batmobile? Do you like Linux? Please, have it. Go away with it. Drive it. And if you ever have a problem, we'll come at your home while you sleep and we'll fix it for you. And the guy goes, no, no, stay away from my house, you freak. That's the reality of operating systems, the way Stevenson sees it. Lots of people agree. They think that Linux should be marketed as an automobile. And there were lots of papers dealing with this issue, how to apply open source thinking to marketing. A professor of business administration said companies should act as references, which is exactly what opensource.org does. I mean, I found people working for Indec Communications and other companies acting, providing references, saying, I've deployed Linux or other pieces of free software internally, and that's why you should use it too. But the important thing is they are visible because there have been those comments and those contact details hosted at the opensource.org website. There should be a pool of marketing resources that the community could draw upon, meaning that there should be an analysis of free software marketplace dynamics that most business people can associate with. Frameworks like 4Ps and conventional cost-benefit analysis, and so on and so forth. And there is the Open Source Enterprise Project, which tries to do exactly that. I don't know whether they've actually produced any relevant documents, but I think they're moving there. And a single marketing message, I mean, that's market as a car, having a single marketing message. It's either the looks, it's either the cost or something. And this is what opensource.org, I mean, the open source business aspect is trying to do. Stress those aspects that are relevant to business needs. Yet, if we look at Linux user groups, we see that people build relationships to each other through those meetings, which is a different form of marketing. I mean, this is marketing. I'm helping you get started with an operating system without expecting any money, any financial motivation. Thus, this marketing is also non-commercial, obviously. I mean, some people call it socialization. I'd like to socialize with people interested about Linux. But most of the times, it's not about socialization only. It's about, I mean, this is effective word-of-mouth marketing lags, if not the most important marketing taking place inside the community. We also have Slashdot, Linux Weekly News, NewsForge, all those kind of weblogs. So people can communicate, they can, as long as they know where the weblog is. I mean, if you don't know about Slashdot, you're obviously not going to end up at Slashdot, unless someone else has, might want to check it out. But the thing is that there is a certain form, a unique form of marketing taking place at those forums of for the continuation of democratic public discourse. People say, I'm interested in that. What do you have to say? Will you criticize it? Will you second this argument? Will you have to modify it? So it's a form of marketing, a genuine form of marketing. So I've got no more noise and speak with a human voice. So, yeah, of course.
But somehow I feel like, for example, recently IBM, when they are marketing free software or open source software, I actually feel like they are marketing business culture rather than their marketing paper culture. So I just wonder, how do you think of this marketing free software? I feel like marketing like MP3 is more successful, because when you buy iPod, it seems that you are supporting somehow the freedom of information. You believe that this thing should be downloadable from the internet, but somehow I feel like nowadays when we are marketing free software, it's more focusing on the business part, how to make money, how the source code really manipulate the source code to apply to your technology rather than just theory. So it's what how do you think of, in terms of cultural marketing, how do you think of this? Is it clear? Do you want me to elaborate a bit?
Yeah, why not? Please, go ahead.
Then you become talking then. Because I just feel like when you are talking about cultural marketing, there should be something, the spirit, a center of the spirit there. But so far, I think I see from the current open source marketing is all about business. And I just wonder whether you could come up with any concrete example to show there actually something, a successful cultural marketing.
The point I was trying to make is that while there is increasingly more corporate money flowing into open source marketing, it's not actually effective. I mean, I see those huge banners saying Oracle makes Linux secure, makes Linux solid, robust, and safe, something like that. So it's not marketing Linux, it's marketing Oracle Linux. And to see that most organizations embarking on free software for their own internal use do it because one of the employees is an IT person and he's familiar with free software, or he's been converted to become a free software enthusiast because of marketing within the community. Marketing, some people wouldn't call it marketing, and indeed marketing has come to be a very dirty word, meaning exploitation and fooling someone into buying something. That's not what I mean right now. I mean, this conference is marketing. Someone who's never used free software, indeed some people who have nothing to do with free software have come to the conference to make connections, to familiarize themselves with what's happening, to get inside. This is marketing. Please.
I strongly disagree. So this is not marketing at all, because the Econox project...
No, I'm not referring to Econox project. Sorry for this ambiguity.
Econox conference, and the very analysis of Econox is to supersede the market, so that free software goes beyond the market and does not need the market. Yes. And that means that... spreading ideas, letting other people get to know of these ideas and spread the ideas. We need new words for them, like perhaps political action or just information or something like that, but not marketing. I think it's very dangerous to call this marketing. And perhaps let me add that there is some...
In this very room,
yeah,
there are people that I see that have come to find out more about how they can deploy free software to make money. And instead of going to Oracle or IBM, calling up IBM saying, could you please send me a couple of consultants to explain me how to make money out of free software, they've chosen to come to Econox. They're not the 99% of the attendants. They're just a small fraction of the attendance.
If this will be more than a small fraction, then I think the Econox idea will die out, because it's not the central idea of Econox to support marketing. It's a side effect that you cannot avoid, perhaps. And let me cite another example of the good thing of spreading ideas of free software in connection with the, I would call it, globalization critique or alternative globalization movement. At the World Social Forum in Mumbai in India this year, there was a translation service, which is very difficult to organize. There was a computer program sending the speeches translators at very different regions on the earth. And there was an instantaneous translation, and this was sent back through the internet to the conference, and via the headsets, all the participants could have translations in their own language. And it was very successful. And for example, the Korean delegation was integrated into the World Social Forum because of this very successful translation. And this has an enormous social impact on the whole movement, that they can really communicate with each other. And all this translation software was free software. And I think this is a good point of joining the free software movement and the globalization critique movement. And perhaps I would call it some kind of anti-marketing free software.
Hey, you should say the name of the system just in terms of marketing.
Actually, I have forgotten the name.
It's called Nomad. As a Nomad, Nomad is it? Yeah.
Ah, thanks a lot.
It's called
Nomad.
Nomad.
How do you spell it?
N-O-M-A-D.
Ah, Nomad.
I think you can find it in Google.
Ah, just try Google, yeah.
I just don't find it neat.
I strongly disagree. I don't really understand what you mean with going beyond the market. That confuses me really. I think markets were there a long time before when there were any capitalists, and hopefully there will be markets after that. I would have hoped that one of the ideas of urban groups and for social movement and other movements was to recreate a marketplace. This marketplace is a place where people come together and share ideas and exchange and do all kinds of nice things to each other. That's what I associate with a market. There might be a specific capitalist market economy that's based on very specific property rights that are exclusive and so on, but market as an idea is really what I would like to see recreated. And yes, marketing is another issue. Maybe all the people who are into marketing are horrible people, but market as an idea is brilliant.
Yeah, that's of course entering a new line of discussion, but very briefly, I have the impression, or there's also analysis being done by Marx, that if you take market and the development of market, you always have that there is competition at the market, and the big companies just swallow the small ones because they have a bigger, better market position. And then you have concentration of capital and then centralization of capital. The very market mechanisms are the deeper source of the current neoliberal globalization. And so you have to put things at the root and really supersede market. So I think there is a long discussion on the economists making this about this point. I just wanted to raise it here, it was real at an economic conference.
No, I'm listening. You have my undivided attention. It's on this lab as well.
I think we have to stop very soon.
Yeah, I think because the plenary session is
at 12. Cool. Should we continue then this discussion over a cup of coffee by the smokers' corner?
Do you have some concluding words?
I'd like to thank you all for coming and for dealing with the questions I'm also dealing with.